And you can see this in a variety of ways. I mentioned John Ibelin, the man from that powerful family of nobles. One of its members, Bélion of Ibelin, had married Maria Comnena. They were the most prominent families opposing Guy of Lusignan. John Ibelin, Lord of Beirut, really directed the High Council at Acre. He was a prominent vassal in Cyprus. He dominated the politics of both kingdoms. In fact, the division between Cyprus and Acre played to his advantage. He's also responsible for being a great constitutionalist. He's responsible for putting together these documents. We got a series of documents known as the Assizes of the Kingdom of Jerusalem. The Assizes are the judicial edicts. And the nobility of the early 13th century becomes very, very proper about constitutional privileges, feudal customs. They have these written down as ways of restricting kings so they don't interfere with what have become long-established rights and customs of the nobility. When Frederick II shows up, the Holy Roman Emperor, and wants to impose more direct control, the nobility immediately opposes Frederick not only with arms, but also with legal arguments. And I'm never sure in those situations of which of the two is more dangerous. And so you have a shift in the politics of Outremer where the nobility has got very mixed feelings about what a new crusade will bring. It could bring a powerful monarch, and there are two of them. We'll look at them. Two very peculiar royal crusaders who closed the crusading movement. One is Frederick II, and the other is St. Louis. Both of them, in effect, to achieve victory, would have to establish courts in Outremer. That would bring in royal administration, taxation, the types of control that most of these barons are now, or nobles are now beginning to come to believe is not what they want. And that's one of the ironies coming out of the sack of 1204, the failure of the Third Crusade, and of efforts to reinforce Outremer. Now, the situation was just about as complicated in Antioch as well, where you had a similar pattern, and Antioch got involved in these hopeless Armenian politics, so that both the court at Antioch and the two successor states to the Jerusalem were all essentially in the same political dilemma. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that in the early 13th century, the division of the European monarchies over the succession to the Holy Roman Empire meant that sending out a large royal crusade was just not likely. That only became a possibility really after the Battle of Bouvines in 1204, well, really after 1220, when Frederick II is finally crowned Holy Roman Emperor. Efforts to launch major royal crusades before that date were really ill-advised. That was one of the problems we'll see with the Fifth Crusade. It was launched before Frederick was in a position to go overseas. The Fifth Crusade is always waiting for Frederick to show up. I always think of the Fifth Crusade as the leaderless crusade. I mean, if you had royal crusades and noble crusades, no one knows who was in charge of the Fifth Crusade. In fact, the leadership kept changing. That was one of the problems. And John of Brienne, who was on it, was certainly not up to the job. You know, he's on extended leave in Cilician Armenia for about a year. And in any case, that those royal forces were just not available. They were too busy trying to sort out who should succeed to the Hohenstaufen domain. And furthermore, Pope Innocent III, as much as he wanted to see a renewal of a crusade, was not in a position to mobilize those royal forces because he was concerned about the succession of a Hohenstaufen emperor who would unite Sicily and southern Italy with the Holy Roman Empire and reduce the papacy to a dependency of the Holy Roman Emperor. So that's an important point always to keep in the background. There were several other important changes that were preventing the types of crusades that were expected in Outremer. And these involved four different types of operations, which I want to discuss, or three, plus the so-called Children's Crusade, which I want to discuss. And it takes us a bit beyond the chronological limits of this lecture, but I do think they offer a very important explanation of why crusading warfare is changing and why crusading warfare eventually goes out of fashion. That is, there is a reluctance on the part of kings and nobles. Many of them descended, in some instances, going back 8, 9 generations, by the 1270s, 1280s, never again wishing to assume the cross, even though there's this long family tradition to do so. And this is an extraordinary point that's often mentioned, missed, you know, that by the end of the 13th century, all of these nobles, all of these families and kings, they just don't listen to the appeal anymore, and the popes are not really inclined to make those appeals. There's almost an embarrassment, a desire to forget that type of activity that comes from the family tradition. And part of it is a result of the way crusading warfare changed. And here there are three operations I want to look at. One of them is the Albigensian Crusade.